Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin here with us this hour. And open forum continues. 888-318-7884. The number if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic people. You got a question about morals. You got a question about philosophy. Maybe a more general question about the nature of reality. It's all welcome when Jimmy's here. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, of course, the author of the super-selling new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello again, Jimmy.
Howdy. How's it going, Si?
Very, very well. I had a lot of fun doing the Bible show yesterday.
Me too.
The Bible's really good. It's a really good book. Brings out the best in people.
They call it that.
The good book.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, you know what, Jimmy? Let me look here. We got so many people on the lines. I feel like we should just start digging in. How do you feel about just digging in?
Sounds good.
All right. Let's go to Aaron in Dallas, Texas, watching on Facebook Live. Aaron in Dallas, Texas, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, hello?
Hi, Aaron. You got a question?
Hey. I was reading this examination of conscience, and I see a line where it says participated in diversions on days of penance, such as like fish fries, ball games, movies, shopping on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday.
Mm.
So I was wondering, what does the church, I guess more clarity on, I guess, what we are required to do on days of penance in regards to, I guess, I know about abstinence and fasting, but I guess more than that.
Beyond that, we're not required to do anything in particular. Since they are days of penance, it's appropriate to do additional forms of penance on those days. And it may be, in an individual's case, that may be refraining from certain enjoyable activities.
Something happened with my mic here.
We got a little microphone. Do you hear it okay? All right, Here, try mine.
Okay. So in a particular person's case, they might voluntarily choose to refrain from certain activities that they find enjoyable, but that's not mandated by church law. And so beyond the required fast and abstinence, it's really up to you what you choose to do. And I'm a little disheartened to see the mention of other activities in an examination of conscience. Whoever wrote the examination of conscience is just expressing his own opinion. He's not representing church teaching, because church teaching does not hold that it's immoral to go to a fish fry on Ash Wednesday. In fact, a lot of churches even hold fish fries on Ash Wednesday. So this is just somebody's opinion. It is not church teaching. And frankly, I personally don't like going beyond church teaching and making up additional rules that people are then finding in an examination of conscience, which is supposed to help them identify sins, because it's not a sin to do those things. And so I would find that things like that would tend to foster scrupulosity, and they're just beyond what the church teaches.
Aaron, thank you very, very much for the call. I hope that that was helpful to you. It's a very busy open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And so I will, we'll be mostly just moving through the calls with a quickness as we go. Mary in Lafayette, Louisiana, listening on KLSG. 90.5 FM is up next. Mary, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I am a cradle Catholic, and I am 76 years old. And just a couple of weeks ago, someone told me that Mary Magdalene was the sister of Lazarus and Martha. And I was very shocked to hear this, because in all my 76 years, I'd never heard anything like that.
So is
that correct?
Okay.
So you will find people who will claim that Mary Magdalene and Mary of Bethany are the same person, but that is not well supported by the biblical evidence, because there were a lot of women named Mary in first century Palestine. It was the single most common female Jewish name, and that's why there are multiple Marys in the New Testament. There's at least three, and I think more than that, But three I can definitely think of off the top of my head, including obviously Jesus's mother. Between the name Mary and the name Salome, half of the women in Jewish women in first century Palestine had one of those two names. So these were staggeringly popular names at the time. And that meant that you needed ways to distinguish between them when you were talking about them. You need to have a way to indicate which Mary we're talking about. And in the case of Mary Magdalene, now normally you would refer to people by their relatives. So like Jesus, or either their relative or their point of origin. So Jesus is sometimes called the son of Joseph, mm-hmm. and Simon is the son of John. But you also had references to points of origin, like Jesus of Nazareth, because he lived in Nazareth for a long time, even though he wasn't born there. And when you look at the descriptions for the two Marys you've mentioned, well, one of them is called Mary Magdalene, and that means a couple of things. One of the things it means is she's from the town of Magdala, which is a town on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. I've driven by there, actually. It's, you know, you can see the ruins of it today. It was a place where, among other things, they grew dates. They had date palms there. It was also a fishing community, like every other community on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. But the fact that Mary is described as being Mary of Magdala, or Mary Magdalene, indicates that she probably didn't have a husband or a living father, because if she did, she would be called Mary the wife of Simon, or mm-hmm. Mary the daughter of Yohanan, or something like that. At least she didn't have a Christian husband or father, because she would be known by their names. Is she also, if she had a son, she could be known by the name of her son, because we have references to other people, you know, like Salome, the mother of James, and things like that. So she probably didn't have any family, at least any male relatives who were Christians, and that's why she was known as Mary of Magdala. On the other hand, the other Mary, who's mentioned in the Gospels of Luke and John, is identified as coming from Bethany, so she's often referred to today, at least, as Mary of Bethany. But she's referred to in the Gospels as Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And that's a big clue that she's not Mary Magdalene, because if she was, number one, she lives in Bethany, not Magdala, but number two, she is identified with respect to her relative. So she's the sister of so-and-so. And they were, she thus did, unlike Mary Magdalene, have well-known relatives in the Christian community that she could be identified by. So it looks like, based on the biblical data, we've got two completely different Marys here.
Is that an acceptable answer, Mary of Lafayette, Louisiana?
Thank you. Definitely, yes. That clears it up perfectly.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Chris in Knoxville, Tennessee, watching on YouTube Live. Chris, your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. First of all, thank you for taking my call. Now, my question is related to the authority of the apostles. I'm trying to preempt my Pentecostal family from using this argument on me. So in Galatians chapter 1, Paul talks about how he has his vision of Jesus, and then he waits 3 years, or he preaches 3 years, before he even goes to talk to the other apostles. And then in Galatians chapter 2, he says that what they were makes no difference to him, that God shows no partiality. So I'm already sold on, you know, Matthew 16 and 18, John 20, places like that. But I'm wondering how I can interpret this section.
Okay, so the specific verse you're looking for an answer to is which one now in Galatians?
It is Galatians 2 and 6.
Galatians chapter 1, verse 2 and verse 6? or chapter 2, verse 6?
No, Galatians chapter 2, verse 6.
Okay. So in Galatians, Paul is, and especially in the early part of Galatians, Paul is concerned with stressing the idea that his gospel does not come from any human source. This is apparently a charge that his critics were making against him. They were saying, oh, Paul, he preaches this watered-down gospel that's man's gospel. He's not giving you the straight story that comes from God. And so Paul is very concerned to show that his gospel does not have a human origin and that it's superior to anything of human origin. And one of the things he does in Galatians chapters 1 and 2 is show the supremacy of his gospel in a variety of different ways. And that is really what determines the narrative that he gives, where he relates certain incidents of his life in recent years that collectively show the supremacy of his gospel. He got it by way of revelation. He didn't get it from any man. He didn't consult with any man to learn it. But eventually, he does go to Jerusalem and to consult with Peter. And that's significant because, you know, why would he, even though he saw James while he was there to stay with Peter. So he wanted to see Peter for some reason. And that is coherent with the fact that Peter was the one to see. He was the leader of the earthly church. So if you're going to see anybody there, it would be Peter. Like if you go to Rome, you want to see the Pope. You know, you may see some cardinal while you're there, but the one to see is the Pope. And that's essentially what Paul is doing here. Then he also goes up again after 14 years, he says, because there were some individuals who were stirring people up by preaching a gospel of circumcision, saying if you're a Gentile, you need to be circumcised and become a Jew if you're going to be saved. And he once again wants to show the supremacy of his message. And he does that by noting that on this second occasion, the other apostles didn't add anything to his message. Specifically, they did not add circumcision to his message and say, Paul, you need to start preaching circumcision. He also, because he knows he's got his message directly from God, that gives him a certain attitude with respect to other church leaders. He wants to make the point that he's not beholden to other church leaders, and he's not subservient to them, and he's not currying their favor. And that's why he says in chapter 2, verse 6, with a bit of rhetorical flourish, that it makes no difference to me who these guys were. God shows no partiality. Now, that doesn't mean that Paul is denying that they were instituted leaders of the church. I mean, Paul himself knew that, you know, Peter and James and John had been commissioned by Jesus himself to be apostles. He knew that Peter had been commissioned to be the head apostle. And that's precisely why he brings up Peter here, because there's no better test case than the most authoritative man in the church to show that your gospel is superior to any man, even Peter. That's why he brings up Peter repeatedly in Galatians 1 and 2. Even though he recognizes that these guys have offices that they got from Christ, he's not going to be intimidated by them on a personal level, and he's not going to be subservient or beholden to them. And that's why he has this rhetorical flourish about whoever they were, I don't care, because God doesn't show partiality. That he's separating the sphere of what are their offices from what's my personal attitude towards them. If you'd like to read more about this, I wrote an article a number of years ago. It's on Catholic.com. It's called Peter in Galatians. And just Google my name, Jimmy Akin, and Peter in Galatians, and it'll come right up.
Thank you, Chris. Hey, come join us if you can. We'd love to have you at the Catholic Answers Conference, September 24th through 27th this year at the Hyatt Regency La Jolla in beautiful and sunny San Diego. The theme of the conference, Who Do You Say That I Am? You can probably guess who that's about. It's about Jesus. We're going to do an entire conference on Jesus. Enjoy the Catholic Answer speakers, Tim Staples, Jimmy, Trent Horn, Carla Broussard, Chris Check, and our special guests, Paul Gondreau Anthony Esselin, Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, Sister Maris Stella from the Sisters of Life, Father Paul Check. Man, that goes on and on. Plus, we're going to do Thursday and Friday editions of this program, Catholic Answers Live, live from the conference. Special early bird pricing is happening now through June. Just enter the promo code EARLY in the promo code box and save $30 off. Full conference ticket includes the banquet dinner with the keynote address. And there's a special room rate right now of $160 per night. For more information and to register, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Listen. Have a question? Listen. We've got answers.
Catholic Answers.
I love it.
Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Raymond Arroyo.
Part of the success we've had on the world over, I attribute to the audience, my relationship with Mother Angelica, and her teaching me that when you sit with someone, you talk to them, and you create an environment where they will tell you things they wouldn't tell anyone else. That ease, that humor, that warmth, she gave me that, and that's what I try to impart and make a part of every interview we do on the world over.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN-TV and radio.
Welcome back. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It is Open Forum here at Catholic Answers Live. Your calls are welcome. 888-318-7884. Let's start out this segment with Julio in right here in Merced, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Julio, your question for Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi, Julio.
So I wanted to know if there was any evidence that Peter himself handed on his authority to the next pope, or if it was just later on, discovered that there was succession.
Well, in the second century, we have a variety of bishop lists that are given for different Christian communities, and in the second century lists, which the first one at least dates to about AD 155. They trace the line of bishops of Rome all the way back to Peter. So already by the mid second century, you have lists that are clearly saying this line of bishops goes back to St. Peter. You also have other writings that are not as historically valuable as the bishop lists, that depict Peter handing his authority on sometimes to St. Clement. And there's some debate about among the early church fathers about exactly who Peter's immediate successor was. According to most accounts, it's Linus. According to some others, though, it was directly to St. Clement. On the other hand, some people have suggested that the way to resolve that is by proposing that Peter ordained St. Clement as a priest himself, and then later St. Clement was elevated to become one of Peter's successors. So that's possible, but we do have a very clear early awareness that that the Bishop of Rome was the successor of Peter in a special way, and that the line of bishops of Rome goes back to him.
Okay, Julio?
Okay.
All right. Thank you. All right. Very good. Thank you very much. Jimmy Akin, our guest for Open Forum this hour, Hugh in Williston, North Dakota, listening on 104.1 Real Presence Radio. Hugh, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, so I was wondering if there were multiple languages before the Tower of Babel, because in the chapter right before the chapter involving the Tower of Babel, it mentions the tongues of the descendants of Noah several times. And then immediately at the start of the next chapter, it says there was one tongue and one speech for all men. So I was wondering if you could shed some light on that.
So I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. Are you asking, was there originally a single human language?
Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, according, so we can look at this from different perspectives. One of the things you have to be aware of when we're reading early Genesis is that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are written in a different genre than later chapters in Genesis and later chapters in other historical works of the Old Testament. This is something that that Pope Pius XII talked about in his encyclical Humanae Generis, that before the arrival of Abraham on the scene in Genesis 12, you have these other chapters that, even though they pertain to history, that's the word he uses, they're not written according to the historical method that is used by later historians. And in Pius XII's words, they're written in simple and metaphorical language for a people but little cultured. That's what he says. So, so we have in Genesis 1 through 11, including the Tower of Babel incident, we have a description of the origins of humanity and how this world situation evolved prior to Abraham, but it's not written in what we would consider a historical manner. It uses different conventions that incorporate a certain amount of metaphor and literary devices and things like that. So, in other words, we need to be careful when we're reading it that we don't impose our own ideas about how history should be written on it and end up misreading it. Now, in terms of, so that's one perspective we need to bear in mind when seeking to interpret this story. Another thing we should bear in mind is that the biblical literature, especially in the Old Testament, is written from the perspective of the Promised Land. And it doesn't really deal with everywhere in the world. So a lot of people have pointed out that when it says in Genesis 6 through 9 that there was this flood that destroyed the world, well, the word for world or earth there is the same as the word for land. So maybe it means a flood that destroyed the Promised Land or the known lands in that region, but not necessarily the whole world. Similarly, when you look at the Table of Nations that come from Noah's descendants, the Table of Nations, there's about 70 nations on that table, and they're all ones that are in this part of the world. There's nothing in here about the Chinese or the American Indians or the Australian Aborigines or anything like that. These are the nations of the known land or the known world that was known to the biblical authors. And so one possibility for what this may mean is that originally the people in this part of the world had a common language. And that's not unreasonable. The various languages that are present in this part of the world are all variations of a language family known as Semitic languages. That includes things like not only Hebrew, but also Egyptian is a Semitic language. So are the Mesopotamian languages like Akkadian and Sumerian. And so you did have a kind of original root language, call it Proto-Semitic if you want, that was common in this part of the world. And the biblical author, now that doesn't necessarily mean absolutely everybody spoke that. There could have been a lone tribe here or there that spoke something else. But the biblical author may be approximating when he says, yeah, everybody spoke the same language, yeah, meaning some kind of Proto-Semitic, and then it diversified after that. On the other hand, if this is meaning to communicate a deeper truth about the origin of human language, well, it so happens that linguists actually talk about an original human language called Proto-World. And if there is, there's sometimes a joke that if you want to startle a linguist, tell them you're a native speaker of Proto-World. Proto-World is thought to have existed, you know, maybe around 40,000 years ago. And although the thesis is controversial, at least one linguist, a guy named Merritt Rulin, by studying different language families around the world, thinks he was able to identify certain words that have survived from the time of Proto-World. So he thinks you can actually identify certain words of this language. One of them is qua, which he proposes was the word for water. Another was tik, which he proposes was the word for finger. Also, there were terms for like father and mother and sister that he thinks are identifiable. Most linguists don't buy that. Most linguists think that proto-world is unrecoverable. I'm actually, though, I'm not that sure. I think that Ruhlen's hypothesis needs to be given some additional consideration, because we are getting evidence that some traditions can survive for staggeringly long periods of time. For example, the Big Dipper. And Cy, I know we've talked about this on previous shows. It looks like the identification of a certain cluster of stars as the Great Bear, Ursa Major, or the Big Dipper is part of Ursa Major. It looks like that is actually over 15,000 years old, and we can show that. And recently, I was reading an article about a volcanic eruption in Australia 35,000 years ago that it looks like the Aborigines have a legend of.
Wow.
And so that legend may have survived for more than 30,000 years, in which case some words of proto-world might still be with us.
Thank you so much for that call, Hugh. Appreciate it. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Right back with more on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. We still have that free ebook available for you, the 20 Answers Prayer Book. We haven't done this before, giving away a 20 Answers book for free in its ebook form. And we'd love you to have it. It's by two of the finest priests we know, Father Hugh Barber and Father Sebastian Walsh, who was here with us yesterday. Just go to shop.catholic.com, look for the banner at the top of the page, and download your free copy of 20 Answers Prayer. Our number here, 888-318-7884. As I said, Jimmy Akin, our guest. And up next, Kristen in Spokane, Washington, listening on the EWTN app. Kristen, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Happy to.
So my question, can you hear me?
Yes, what's your question?
Okay, sorry. My question is involving our current spiritual warfare, and I'm sorry if it's a little heavy. I just want to ask, as a Catholic, do you believe in demonic possession or oppression? And if so, why does it happen, or what's the reasoning behind it?
Well, demonic possession clearly exists because it's testified to in Scripture. Jesus dealt with multiple individuals who were demonically possessed, and he then exorcised them to drive out the demon. In terms of demonic oppression, which is kind of a step down from demonic possession, oppression is where demons are really, you know, doing things to put pressure on you and harm you and things like that, but you're not actually possessed by them. That also clearly exists, and we see examples of that in Scripture. In terms of why does it happen, well, God allows it to happen. And the reason for that is somewhat mysterious. It's a subcase of what's called the problem of evil. And it's just another variation on why would a good God allow something bad to happen. And it's in some cases, it's easy to see what good God is producing or by allowing a given evil. You know, if you put your hand on a hot stove and it burns, well, that the evil of that pain is actually playing a useful role because it alerts you to get your hand off the stove before more damage is done to it. In other cases, it's harder to see what the evil is, but at least in this life, because we don't have the full picture in this life. What the Catechism of the Catholic Church says is that God would not allow any evil if he didn't have a way to bring a greater good out of it. And in the next life, the Catechism indicates, we'll have a better idea of exactly what those goods were that he was producing by allowing various evils. In the case of demonic possession, it's not as easy to see as, you know, why God would let you burn your hand on a stove, but we can have faith that there is some good that God is bringing out of these situations. And it may even be something that we can identify on occasion, at least what part of the good is. For example, one of the things we talked about yesterday on the show is why Jesus, even though he normally tells people he does miracles for when he's in Israel to keep it quiet, mm-hmm. when he's in the land of the Gadarenes, he tells the Gadarene who he exorcises to go and tell people what God has done for them. And that's an instance where he's in a Gentile territory, and the Gentiles had heard of the God of the Jews, but they didn't worship God. And so by encouraging this Gadarene to go and tell people about what God has done for him, he's spreading the message of the true God and his power and how he can help you and defeat the demons in our lives. And so that could be, or at least I can put it this way, that's one of the goods that God brought out of this particular case of possession, was spreading the message of the true God and his power over demons in this Gentile area.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Kristen. Appreciate that. Let's go to John in Maryland, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. John, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, how are you doing today? My name is John. I'm from Maryland. And my question is about Eucharistic miracles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm going, you know, there's Eucharistic miracles, 500 AD. I don't know the exact date, but, you know, 500 AD, 1000 AD, 1500 AD. And we have the Shroud of Turin. We have all these things. And if the DNA matches, I feel like with the way science is right now, there is no way for a scientist to recreate that if all the DNA matches, right? So what I don't understand is why we don't use that as a tool to go after the people who are knocking religion, saying there is no God.
I think, John, that's very clear. Yeah, why don't we just, you have all these apparent instances of Christ's flesh and blood, including on the shroud. Mm-hmm. Why not just test them all, and if all the same, that basically proves it's Christ.
Well, so in the first place, I mean, John was asking, why aren't we already doing this? And you answered part of that question,
which is
because you said, why don't we test them all? We haven't done those tests. We have not run genetic sequencing on all of these different artifacts.
I see.
And so, you know, there's been some genetic research done on some of them. There's been blood typing, for example, done on the Shroud of Turin. And there are some challenges to deal with in this area because, you know, the Shroud of Turin, for example, is a relic that has, even though it's now in a glass case, it was exposed to people touching it and kissing it and things like that. So it's going to have more than just Jesus's DNA on there.
Yeah.
Having said that, if you did look at a variety of these artifacts and run DNA tests on them, and it turned out that there's a single person's DNA on each one of them, even if there's other DNA too, there is one person's DNA that's on all of these things or is part of all of these things. Skeptics would still have some avenues by which to argue that they don't think this is a miracle because it is possible to culture cells that have a particular DNA profile. And so skeptics would immediately question the provenance of the DNA on these different artifacts and say, well, could some believer scientist, maybe the head of the DNA Test the Relics project, maybe he secretly went around and salted this DNA. He cultured some DNA in a lab and then he took it out of the Petri dish and went around and put it on all these artifacts. So I'm not saying there's no way to use this, but it would be difficult to do it non-destructively because what you would need to do is not just look at the surface and take a sample of the surface of these different objects. You would need to have rigorously enforced protocols that prevented any kind of fraud, and you would need to take the protocols not from the surface, take the samples not from the surface, but from within these Eucharistic miracles, for example. And it would, it could potentially be done, but it is, it's not. It would face several challenges, and skeptics would have various ways they could try to argue against it if it turned out that there is common DNA on all of these things.
John, I hope that's helpful. I think it's required now that we have a question on DNA for me to ask the question I believe I may have asked you before, but endlessly curious about this. Are we ever going to clone woolly mammoths and have them back again? And are you in favor or opposed?
I actually think we are likely to have woolly mammoths back. And personally, I think that would be cool.
Okay, yeah, me too. I don't believe Jeff Goldblum that, oh, you're going to unleash. You know who Jeff Goldblum?
I know. Woolly mammoths and tyrannosaurs are not the same thing.
Oh, I'd do the tyrannosaurs too.
I'm a little cooler about bringing, latest studies based on the encephalization quotients of tyrannosaurs indicates they were smart as chimps and hunted in packs.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
maybe don't want to bring those back in exactly the form they
definitely
were.
Definitely not with the woolly mammoths. All right, okay, so the all-important woolly mammoth question, whenever we have a DNA question, I start thinking, oh, I wonder how that woolly mammoth thing is coming. That's just me, sorry. John, thanks for the question. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is honored by the church as one of the greatest enemies of clergy sexual abuse.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
In his time, St. Peter Damian fought against the many vices of contemporary clergy, especially sexual abuses among the clergy. In 1051, he wrote the Book of Gomorrah that is still considered essential reading for fighting abuse today. He died in 1072.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Just the phones just stay so full, so I'm going to keep moving. Frank in Long Island, New York, you are next. Frank, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, guys. I'm just finished reading The Bible as a Catholic Book. Great book, Jimmy.
Yeah, thank you. Good.
The only question I had was your dating of the Book of Acts.
Uh-huh.
Because you state that there was no resolution to Paul's trial, therefore, the logical explanation, the trial didn't happen. And therefore,
it hadn't happened yet.
It hadn't happened at that point, right? Mm-hmm. So you dated it between 60 and 62 AD.
Mm-hmm.
So I can think of, did you think of the possibility that Luke may have been involuntarily stopped writing, or that the scroll was lost, because he lived, I think, until 84 AD, and he had plenty of time to finish it. So could you address that?
Well, we may have some sources indicating that Luke lived, you know, for a significant period of time after Acts, but that's not as firm. So I wouldn't say, well, we knew Luke, you know, continued to live for a significant period. I think we have to be a little careful about that, because we don't have solid evidence for that. In terms of could there have been a sequel to Acts? Well, it's possible. However, I don't think it's likely. And this is a theory that's been discussed. Maybe, you know, Luke was planning on writing a sequel and then couldn't, or maybe he did and it was lost. I don't think either one of those is likely, though. One of the reasons is you look at, so first of all, the best case or the best understanding of the Gospels and Acts that I think scholarship has today is that these were not lone documents. It's not like there was a time when there was a single copy of Luke in circulation. Instead, what they would do is what modern publishers do. The author would write an initial version, and then they would have multiple copies of it made, and it would be released at the same time. So when I think Theophilus, who's mentioned at the beginning of Luke and Acts, was Luke's patron paying for all of this. I think Theophilus was a well-off Christian who subsidized Luke in his literary efforts. And so when both the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts were written, there were, I don't know, a dozen copies or so that are sent out to different people. Theophilus would have had a copy himself. Luke would have had a copy. There would have been a copy in, you know, the major church in, and probably more than one of the major churches in Rome. And also copies likely would have been sent to other major Christian communities, like maybe Ephesus, where Paul spent a lot of time, or Corinth. So if there had been a sequel to Acts written, a third volume in the series, they would have done the same thing. There would be multiple copies made. And because of the fame of the original Gospel of Luke and the first volume of the Book of Acts, Acts 2 or Second Acts would have been very quickly copied by other communities. And there would be too many copies of it in circulation for it to have been lost, given Luke's prestige and what it would have chronicled about church history. So because it would have covered, you know, the deaths of Peter and Paul and maybe the events of AD 70, people would have wanted to read that.
Right.
And so I think that makes it problematic to suppose that there was a third volume. But there's also another reason, I think, that it's unlikely that there was a third volume. And that's because if you really, I can break it into two. The Book of Acts doesn't stop at an appropriate point if the trial had occurred. What you want to do if the trial has occurred is tell us the outcome. It's kind of a modern thing to like end a movie or something with a cliffhanger and say, you got to get the next installment.
Right. It's not a Marvel movie where what's going to happen?
So the natural shape of a story is what Luke would have conveyed. And the natural shape of the story of Paul's trial, which he's been dealing with for a quarter of the entire book, he would have gotten us an indication of the end of the trial. Just like if you read the Gospel of Luke, he doesn't leave us hanging about Jesus's resurrection. You know, that's the major culminating event in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus rises from the dead, and he tells us all about it. He doesn't say, oh, wait until Acts. He doesn't even do that with the ascension. If you look at the end of the Gospel of Luke, at the very end of chapter 24, Jesus takes the disciples out to Bethany, he blesses them, and he ascends into heaven. So we have a little preview of the ascension of Jesus, and then we pick it up in Acts,
right,
and he gives us in more detail.
Yeah.
Also, so I think Luke would have done the same thing. If the trial had occurred, he would have said, and here's what happened at the trial. He might have then given more data about the trial at the beginning of volume 3, but the fact he doesn't give us any data about the conclusion of the trial at the end of Acts, I think, is an indication that he was not planning a third volume. Also, and this is the second half of the second reason, if you look at the way the gospel of Luke ends, he's clearly setting up the beginning of Acts, because he's telling the disciples things like, stay in Jerusalem until you're clothed with power from on high. And that then gets elaborated as the day of Pentecost in the gospel, in the book of Acts.
Yeah.
So he also, instead of like Matthew and Mark, instead of showing the disciples going back up to Galilee, since he knows he's going to start with the day of Pentecost in Acts, he doesn't record the Galilee post-resurrection narratives, only post-resurrection narratives set in the vicinity of Jerusalem. And so he deliberately does not use some of the traditions that he knew about from Mark and Matthew that said, oh yeah, and they also went to Galilee.
Right.
He excludes those because he's setting up what he's going to do at the beginning of Acts. Well, you look at the end of the book of Acts, he's not setting up anything. You know, he's just totally inconclusive. It doesn't read like it would naturally flow into another work the way that the Gospel of Luke naturally flows into the book of Acts. So I think it's possible there could have been a sequel. I don't think there was one, and I don't think he was envisioning there to be one. I think he was merely meaning to write up to his own day, which was when Paul was in his first Roman captivity.
Thanks, Frank. I hope it was helpful. We got to move now to Matt in Peoria, Illinois, listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Matt, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is related to the to the gospel story where Jesus and the disciples are walking through the fields and the disciples are plucking grain. Mm-hmm. And the Pharisees, rebuke the disciples for doing that on the Sabbath. And Jesus cites as the story of David eating the showbread and kind of alludes to, well, and then my take was in extenuating circumstances, the law is, not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, essentially. And my struggle with that has always been how to reconcile that with, first of all, Jesus saying, I came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And then kind of more fundamentally, it's, if you open that up to say, well, in extenuating circumstances, we can just discern when to follow the law and when to ignore it. And that seems like a slippery slope for, how do we know which laws, we keep, which laws we don't? We start, making relativistic decisions in terms of morality.
All right. So the question has to do with whether Jesus is a lawbreaker or a fulfiller of the law. Like, am I in the ballpark there, Matt?
Well, no, I guess more fundamentally, I know Jesus fundamentally, is the truth. But then by what authority did David eat the showbread? And how do we say, well, David wasn't breaking the law in... how do we rationalize that?
David violated the strict terms of the law, which required that only priests eat the showbread. And he did so because he was in an emergency circumstance. So David had what we would call today a necessity defense, that this was an urgent, emerging circumstance that the law did not provide for, but there was an urgent need to deal with the situation, and so that justified a departure from the ordinary law, because the law is framed to take care of ordinary situations. It's not, the law of Moses is not written in such a way that it would deal with every possible situation in life. And so consequently, David reasoned, it's necessary that I get these men some food, so we're going to go ahead and do that. And God will be okay with that because he understands the urgent need. And so David, if you'd asked him, presumably would have articulated a necessity defense. Jesus then concurs with David. One of the things you find about Jesus, not just in this passage, but in other passages as well, is Jesus subordinates the ritual requirements, especially of the Mosaic law, to human needs. So he says the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So that means when man has an urgent need on the Sabbath, it's okay to take care of it, even if it means doing some work, because the Sabbath is an institution that's fundamentally meant to serve human needs. And in the same way, you have this ritual requirement that only the priests get to eat the showbread, but that also can be overridden by an urgent human need. And so that is the basic principle that Jesus is using in situations like this. Now, does that mean you can violate any law in the right circumstances? The answer to that is no. There are laws you can never break. You can never commit adultery. You can never deny Christ. There are moral absolutes. How do we know which commands fall into which category? Well, Christian theologians down through the centuries have looked at the law of Moses and said, well, it has some requirements that are straight out of morality. They're just built into human nature. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder people. But then there are others that regulate the national life of Israel, like build rails around the top of your roof so people don't fall off and get killed. You know, today we don't spend time up on our roof, so we don't need rails in the same way. And then there are ritual requirements like circumcision and the Sabbath and who gets to eat the showbread. And Christian theologians have proposed that while the moral principles, at least the fundamental moral principles, are inviolable, that these other laws that were written to regulate the national and religious life of Israel, that they contain principles that we need to honor, like reverence for God or making sure we have adequate safety precautions in society, but they don't have to be observed to the letter by Christians in all circumstances. Christians don't need to get circumcised. They don't need to keep the Sabbath. They do need to honor the principles that are underlying those commandments, which, for example, Christians do on Sunday instead of Saturday. So there is a way to balance the variability in the Mosaic law without falling into pure moral relativism. And that's one of the major tasks of Catholic moral theology. So I'd say if you want to learn more about that, read some Catholic moral theology. The Catechism is a good starting point.
Thanks, Matt. I'm going to go quickly see if we can get Ann on. Ann in Canton, Ohio. Thanks for being with us. Can you ask your question real quickly so Jimmy can have a chance to answer it?
Yes, I've been told from a Baptist friend that when Jesus turned water into wine, that he was just making grape juice and mm-hmm. not the wine.
What about that, Jimmy?
So we can show that that's not a good interpretation of John chapter 2. The way we can show it is Jesus transforms the water into wine, and the stewards take the new wine that he's made to the chief steward, and the chief steward proclaims it to be a really good vintage. Okay.
Yeah.
And he says what most people do is they bring out the good wine first, mm-hmm. and then after the guests have drunk freely and have lost their taste, they bring out the cheap stuff.
That doesn't happen with grape juice.
That was my point. This does not happen with grape juice. You don't lose your taste after you drink grape juice. It's only alcoholic wine that causes that to happen. And since the chief steward of the feast says that the good wine causes people to lose their taste, and he identifies that what Jesus made as good wine, that implies that the wine Jesus was made is alcoholic and could cause people to lose their taste if they drank enough of it.
Ann, thank you. You did a great job getting that question out quickly. I appreciate that. Allowed us to get a good, solid answer into you before we had to bring the show to a conclusion. Jimmy, Mysterious World this week.
Yeah.
What's up?
Nemesis Death Star Theory.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that. You told us yesterday, Nemesis Death Star Theory, that there is a
second sun in the solar system.
And we just can't find it. It seems unlikely that you would lose an entire star.
Well, if it's a brown dwarf and it's really far away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
A brown dwarf.
Like, also, we may already, I mean, according to the scientists who've proposed this theory, we may already know it. It may be a red dwarf. We know lots of red dwarfs, but we haven't measured all their distances.
Oh, all right. Well, fair enough then. You know what, Jimmy? Whatever happens with the sun and the star and all that, as long as the woolly mammoth is coming back, I am satisfied.
Okay.
I'm happy.
Easy to please.
I'm happy with the state of science as it is if it can bring back a woolly mammoth. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. His book is The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get it right now at shop.catholic.com or get the audio version at Audible or at Amazon. Also, what we were just referring to, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, is Jimmy's podcast, which drops each Friday. Check it out by just Googling Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Tomorrow, I know we got Joe Heschmeyer. Is he here to talk about Peter? We're going to talk about Peter tomorrow. What are we talking about with Joe tomorrow? Do you remember? Tomorrow, an exciting surprise show with Joe Heschmeyer. Join us. Don't miss a minute of the scintillating Joe Heschmeyer and his surprise topic tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.